All right, welcome to the second episode. I'm delighted to be joined by Borzoi Boskovic. How are you, Borzoi?
I'm very honored to be so I was hoping to be the inaugural guest, but I'll settle for second place, especially if it's second place to Morgoth, because
Yeah, that's perfect.
he's an excellent guest, as I discovered. I love doing that pause button with him.
Yeah, Borgoth did a pause button with Borzoi. That's on the right stuff that biz. You should check it out. Well, and you also do the third rail. Anything else you got going on? That's your two shows on the right stuff.
Yeah, those are my two shows. Well, if you're on the pause button RSS feed, I don't post this to TRS, because it's just like, one, it doesn't I don't think it fits TRS that well, and two, it's more of like a Twitter ecumenical thing. But I with the original Pine Bros, which later became Graph Twitter, we have our own Graphcast now, which is a It's a simulation of serious and shit posting, which is generally what our chat is like. And I'm working on the second episode's recorded. I just have to edit it. It's a going to be a you love it or you hate it thing. But give it a chance. If you're looking for a online friend simulator, it might fit the bill.
Well, perfect for these times then. It's funny actually, the pause button, movie reviews, whatever, because I've noticed like everyone I've talked to about the virus to express how serious and how real it seems, they all say it's just like a movie. I feel like if Rick Roderick or someone was around, he'd have a field day with that.
Yeah, I might I was gonna do like a post or tweet about this, but there's do you know the website TV Tropes?
No.
Okay, so TV Tropes is this it started from a bunch of fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and the reason why it started with them was because these if you've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it was Joss Whedon's baby, and he is the patron saint of media obsessed nerds, and so who think because you're aware of certain cliches and tropes in television and movies that makes you intelligent, and that you like therefore if you superficially play with tropes and cliches, it makes you a really good writer. Well, they started this website where they started cataloging common tropes and cliches in all forms of media, and on its face, it's not a bad idea. Like, I mean, that's that for if you're into media analysis, that's actually a great idea to have a nice little database where you can track all this stuff. Well, it quickly turned, and you can find like a lot of like Encyclopedia Dramatica or other like LOL cow sources on the site. It quickly turned into, because of the kind of people it attracted, it quickly turned into this drama-filled, narcissistic cesspool of just the absolute worst people on the internet who define their lives by media and have way too much unwarranted self-importance. In fact, they had to even axe complete parts of the site because people were practically writing fan fiction about themselves. But even to this day, the site's still a problem. Like, you can go, there's a they have a category in the site called Your Mileage May Vary, which the whole purpose of that is to for the more subjective parts of analyzing media tropes, where people like, and if you can't be that objective, then it goes into that one. Well, they created one of those for real life. So they started, once again, the problem starts again, where they begin writing real life like it's a media property. They'll describe like World War II as like a show that went on longer than it should have. And it's a very peculiar way to be looking at history. So it doesn't surprise me then that the way people are going to approach the present day of the things that we're going through completely through the lens of media and how they are a character within that.
There's also an element of like, it seems like nothing ever really happens. Like we're not really part of any power process or like kind of like the end of history in a sense, but like I don't know. It just nothing ever changes. Everyone is so cynical about politics and everything else. They don't feel like they're part of a historical epoch. Like it feels like that's all over. We're in some kind of like eternal present now. It's weird.
Everyone's desperate for a happening because they want, for one of two reasons. Either they want a spectacle, and they either want to see the spectacle or be part of the spectacle, or they're doing it because it's a chance to actually do something, to engage, as you said, in the power process. And we're all susceptible to this. I'm susceptible to this. In fact, I actually just had to, it was funny because I kind of wanted to talk about this because I got three separate messages last night from different people telling me that they're concerned because of where I claim to live. I often claim to live in Michigan. Maybe I do, maybe I don't, but people were messaging me because there has been rumors flying around that there's going to be like a lockdown of some kind in Michigan, like DHS level lockdown on Michigan. And I had
is funny. Before you go on, I got two phone calls on Sunday night of people who called me saying like, oh my God, like I have it on credible information. The country's going into military lockdown Monday at 11 a.m. and all this stuff was flying around.
My sister's brother's sister-in-law's cousin's friend works for the Air Force, and they're nuking every metropolitan city starting tomorrow. I heard it. You heard it here, folks. But I admitted that I got excited by the thought of, well, what if I am in a place where there's a lockdown, and what would I do? And I was making jokes about, well, I'm going to go in the woods, or I was telling people like, well, if there were a lockdown, I'm going to, like, this is like, here's, I'm going to do A, B, and C, and I'm going to do it for X, Y, and Z. Nothing illegal, of course, but basically my chance to prove myself, to actually do something instead of being an extremely online, overly politically aware person who doesn't really have power, especially because they align themselves with an idea, especially because they align themselves against the state and corporate ideology. It's a very exciting thing to think about. Like, I might be in interesting times. I might be in dicey times. I might be able to leave my mark on that. I might be able to actually change something, because that option is generally not afforded to us in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. I think there's also like an element of guilt as well, where like all these shitbags that just like consume product and use Instagram all the time and that, like, I think in a way they're almost hoping for something like this. Like, if everything just collapsed tomorrow, they'd feel a sense of relief. Like, there's a great amount of guilt that goes along with like being a consumer in the West now. I mean, you see it with like people, you know, more and more people kind of instead of spending money on product now, they're spending it on experiences, and everyone wants to be like the worldly traveler making vlogs of their travels around Europe, or going to visit Tibetan monks and find themselves at the River Ganges and all this shit. So there's also you can see this, there's like a shift to a kind of search for authenticity among like young Westerners, but that's actually becoming more of a product than anything. Like, that's more because, you know, the commodification process has to move beyond like physical products. So it's moving into the digital now, where everything's going on streaming, and it's also moving into experiences. And like, if you look at the growth of travel and everything related to it, you know, Airbnb and all this stuff, that's like exploding like exponentially in the hundreds of millions every year.
I think you've hit the nail on the head as well with describing as guilt. You're in your 20s, right, Keith?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've said this before, that's not a secret. I'm in my 30s. I'm an elder millennial. And that's a deep sense of something I have felt, and I've noticed that's something I've seen as well in millennials from within the same age range as me, is the sense of our wasted 20s, that we didn't do anything, you know. And there's, for some, they just got completely subsumed into that bug man child, soy boy, whatever term we're currently using. Everyone knows what I mean. Being subsumed into that lifestyle, if you resisted that in any way, for a lot of people I've noticed within my age range, we have like this almost cultural or social survivor's guilt. Like, why didn't we do something? Why didn't we stop it? Especially when you know more now than you knew then, you end up beating yourself up a lot. It's like, what could I have done if I had, if if I had understood better, maybe if I had opened my eyes sooner, maybe if I had listened to those people I had dismissed years ago. For a lot of millennials, it's difficult to deal with that guilt sometimes, just because the options of how to deal with that are very limited. And so, as you say, what most people end up doing is they go into trialing or the Instagram, they go into these little mini cultural attempts to make meaning out of their lives. But because, again, it's participating in the spectacle culture, it's going to be hollow at the end of it, which is why this is going to be interesting, especially if these shutdowns continue on. Like, this is going to cause, I think, an existential crisis for a lot of people, because a lot of people are going to be forced to be by themselves, and they're going to eventually run out of things to occupy their time with, and they're going to be forced to actually face themselves in the mirror and take an actual honest assessment, an honest look, and on, you know, there's a term for it, but basically where you're going through this, an honest inventory. They have to take an honest inventory of themselves. And I think some people are going to be made stronger out of that. I think a lot of people are going to go probably the other route and become weaker because of it, because they can't deal with maybe some of the uglier truths they're going to be forced to face about what they've done with their time and what they can do with their future.
Yeah, I actually retweeted something that was pretty funny. There was some girl that was like saying that this was terrible, and she was like listing off all her mental illnesses, and she was like, I can't be alone with my thoughts. What am I going to do?
That's the hardest thing for people, and this is why one of the reasons why I got into Kaczynski in the first place was because on the margins, this was the of his works. This is the well, not on the margins, like in his work, he was saying exactly this kind of stuff. Like, this is what a complex technocratic society leads to, because and this is going back to Jacques Ellul, a technological society. People don't shape the technology. They become shaped by the technology, because the needs of technology demand that. I use this example a lot because this might not seem intuitive at first until you think about this. But, you know, when you build roads and the like, you can't build them however you want. They have to be made efficient. And what ends up having to be done, because you built the automobile, you build these roads, and then you reshape the towns you live in or build new towns because of that. And now you can't just walk wherever you want. You have to walk in ways that you avoid the dangerous road now. You are being shaped to technology. And we see that, especially now with much more digital technology in our hands and with us being in screens all the time, we end up getting shaped by that. And for human beings, that's not a healthy way to live. So people have completely forgotten the ability to be alone with their thoughts. It's not back in the 1700s or so, when you'd be in church and that's where you would contemplate, that, or, you know, being in your home and contemplating there. There's noise everywhere, and people are frankly scared of their own thoughts now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every traditional society saw contemplation as kind of the final end of people. But yeah, that's, you know, that I think the example Ellul used was the clock, you know, that the clock is brought in to tell the time first, but then, you know, you start living according to the clock, and then, you know, it strikes the hour and you have to do certain tasks, and eventually that it kind of leads to the sort of commodification of time itself. You know, time is money, and you start to kind of break time down into units and judge it by efficiency. So yeah, it does. I mean, that's one thing that's completely missing from modernity that doesn't really get discussed as much. There's no space for contemplation, or it's not something that's discussed. I mean, even when you see like these celebrities that are like really into meditation or whatever, it's like, I don't know, it's weird. They do it according to like a set routine. Like, I'm gonna jog at this time, and then I'm going to do like my yoga and meditation at this time. It's almost like the meditation is still like a product to be consumed in their minds or something.
Mm-hmm. There's we forget how malleable human beings also are. It's and how exacerbated that's become under this kind of technological society that we live in. If you were to go back in time, it's not just that you have more technology and more knowledge than your ancestors, or maybe their language is a little bit different from yours. What you're going to find is your ancestors are going to be completely alien to you. I mean, it means a lot. When we say that the past is a foreign country, we often use that in the sense of that because we are so far away from values, it seems so distant to us, or because of the things that have happened, we've become strangers and alien. While all that stuff is true, people don't understand the extent to which how alien things used to be. And it results of how we are shaped by so strongly by our environment and the technology within it and the values that are transmitted to us. There was a French historian, Lucien Favre, who wrote an interesting work called The Problem of Unbelief in the 16th Century. And he was analyzing religion in France in the 16th century. And the conclusion he drew is that it was literally impossible for you to be an atheist in 16th century France. And what he means by that is your life was so saturated by religion. It was everywhere. It permeated, and because of that saturation, it permeated your thoughts that it just would not have been conceivable for you to think of there being no God. You might have heretical religious beliefs. You might have beliefs of your own, but this just, there was no context for people to be able to have that unbelief. And he went through everything he could in 16th century France. Like, he analyzed everyone down to the most mundane pieces of writing and notes and whatever they had on hand. Like, he tried to reconstruct what did a 16th century French person think like. And the conclusion he drew is like, just that's what their lives were. And that is so bizarre and alien to us, this idea that they didn't have the kind of doubts that we have. We would not be able to relate to that. And that was 400 years ago, or 500 years ago. We can't relate to that on any level now, nor would they be able to relate to us on any level. We'd be just as alien to them.
Yeah, the philosopher Charles Taylor has a massive book, The Secular Age, and the thesis of it is the same as that, basically, that, you know, we have this way of looking at a religious worldview now as kind of like one belief among many or something you kind of pick up, but a lot of times when people look at the history of it, they've kind of failed to take into account that this was like, you know, your entire worldview, that it did make complete sense in itself. There was nothing irrational about it because, you know, every part was kind of interlocked with every other part. So to, you know, to present someone with some rational kind of Christopher Hitchens style question about the existence of God would make no sense because it was totally obvious for all the other aspects of their lives. So it's this, but I mean, there's, you know, we think we're beyond that. But I mean, the one kind of unquestioned thing in our age is sort of instrumental reason or rationality. And, you know, that's what underlies every kind of political discussion. And, you know, Lull talked about this as well, that the, you know, while it's a rational process, it ultimately leads to the irrational because this idea of growth permeates everything now to the point where you have the, you know, the desire for constantly growing standard of living. And at the same time, concurrently with that, you've constantly grown population and everything else, whereas oftentimes those two things are in contradiction. I mean, you know, you look at something like the environmentalist movement, and in the 70s was the Club of Rome and all this stuff, and they were still kind of Malthusian, and it was all about population. And now it's like no one touches population, and they all have this, all the environmentalists seem to have this weird absolute faith in progress that we're going to invent our way out of it, and technology and green energy and the Elon Musks of the world are going to save it, and, you know, we're all going to be better consumers, and that's how we get out of it, basically. Like, more you know, even the most supposedly radical environmentalists, at the end of the day, they just want kind of a more ethical capitalism.
That's actually the funny thing you mentioned with the Club of Rome and all that, because early on when Graph Twitter first started, and for your audience, if they're not familiar with Graph Twitter, it started because originally the guys who were reading Kaczynski and Linkola and the like, were, they didn't subscribe to any single ideology. It was a techno-skeptic, aesthetic kind of goofy Twitter circle. And they, originally had the pine tree, but when that got associated with eco-fascism, that was when a lot of the core, a lot of guys just ended up going dark. But for the core guys that stuck around, who didn't want to be associated with that, Graph Twitter grew out of that. And where the graph came from was from the Club of Rome. It was from their study on the limits to growth. Now, that's been used to criticize Graph Twitter. Now, we've always used that in the sense like this is just a remind, like in a Tainter-esque critique, that this is just a reminder of how fragile your civilization and culture is. But the funny thing is about that limits to growth studies, the Club of Rome, after they did that, then did a couple more studies where they use that to push for this population new, like kind of this elite control, population control scheme, which I don't know to what extent they still believe in it. The elites, I think they're pivoting on some of their schemes. It's hard to tell what they're doing, what they're up to these days, and what they're in favor of. But for people like that, the decelerationists came out of the limits to growth stuff as well. Decelerationism in terms of technology, they came out of that limits to growth stuff, but they just disregarded everything that the Club of Rome said after, and basically pointed out like this is not sustainable long term. The way that we pointed out is that a lot of those limits to growth studies were correct. This is just simply not sustainable. So instead of having these schemes, though, it's about how do we manage the decline, because progress is a cult, and that cult is just quickly becoming a death cult. So that's kind of where a lot of us are trying to, hopefully, like being an undercurrent of trying to push environmentalism, especially awakening up this right wing kind of environmentalism, where the idea is that illiberal solutions are, first of all, the only way that the environment can be protected, but also it's about incorporating a more holistic view of humanity, and with nation being part and parcel of that. And there might be some tough questions that need to be answered, and there's, you know, tough times are going to need to be dealt with, but the healthiest way, and to me the correct environmentalist take to have is to synthesize the love of nation and the love of nature, so that you have nations being stewards to their own lands, cooperating. And this is the pipe dream part, where you have them cooperating with each other to try and bring the damage down. That's, you know, like the easier said than done, especially because the rush is for industrialization. But right wingers have to have an environmental outlook, otherwise they're going to outsource their responsibility to these elites and to their new left drones that basically think they can have unlimited migration and whatever else, you know, unlimited migration with peace, and as long as we all just start eating bugs.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, that's the funny thing as well, is that if people that are racialist and they're thinking like the racialist argument about white genocide or preserving your people or whatever is basically an ecological argument, and you know, the way to make that argument is not in a liberal framework. I mean, Aaron Innes, and he's setting out the fundamental tenets of deep ecology. Yeah. I think the main one is that the diversity of life is a good in itself and should be preserved. So I mean, that's the problem is with environmentalists like that, the Derek Jensen types, they'll apply that to any species of animal, but then when it comes to humans, you know, we're all one race, whatever, and there's obviously completely ignoring biology there, which is, it kind of shows in a sense how dominant the current of liberalism is, that even these deep ecology people that will sometimes go so far as like advocating violence to bring down the system, they're still not willing to do a racism or to breach that tenet of political correctness. I always thought that was a weird one.
Well, what scares me so much, and this is why I believe it's incumbent upon right wingers or third positionists. I know there are a lot of third positionists that just don't feel any affinity to even being called right wing. But both of these factions or these viewpoints it's so important to take on that environmentalist question, because you cannot let these people have it. You cannot you cannot put that aside, and it has to be claimed. There's I wrote an article for the American Sun called "The Last Man of the Deep Wild," which was on this topic. It was about Penty Linkola, the famous deep ecologist, the famous misanthropic deep ecologist. And what I found most interesting when I was reading Can Life Prevail was that he quoted a philosopher. He was actually the philosopher that had succeeded Ludwig Wittgenstein in his Cambridge chair. And Linkola, despite being this grumpy old fisherman who takes care of birds and does fishing for most of his life, he is admired all around the world and has had a lot of correspondence with a lot of famous people in history. And the analytic philosopher's name was George Hendrik von Wright. Well, George Hendrik von Wright was familiar with Penty Linkola's famous lifeboat ethics problem. So the lifeboat ethics scenario is probably the most famous Penty Linkola quote, which is what's pointed to for him being like a genocidal maniac, is what to do when a ship carrying 100 passengers has suddenly capsized and only one lifeboat is available for 10 people in the water. When the lifeboat is full, those who hate life will try to pull more people into it, thus drowning everyone. Those who love and respect life will instead grab an axe and sever the hands clinging to the gunwales. That quote has always caused a stir among liberal people who have encountered Penty Linkola. And the thing is about Linkola is that he is not a systematic thinker in any kind of way. He's not a philosopher. He comes from a very educated family. He's a very smart man. But a lot of his stuff is just more of his own idle thoughts or speculations or ideas that he's not trying to make a complete ideology out of. He's singularly focused on protecting the environment, so he'll entertain a lot of different thoughts on it, and he may not necessarily always agree with the things he's saying or even stick to them. And he's said as much. Well, people who encounter this tend to have like their own moment where they have to start considering it. It's because that's why Linkola is so, I think, popular, is just because he forces that issue out into the open, and he forces it in very plain language. You cannot have a maximalist view of protecting life. It's just not possible, because life depends on preying upon other life in order to live. It's the same problem like why you can't have the wolf and the sheep live together. One's got to eat the other. But George Hendrik von Wright wrote to Linkola about this problem. He said, "As you may know, I hold you in high regard as a thinker. At least in this country, you're the most lucid and profound among truthful prophets. As to what practical conclusions to draw from realizing the truth, this is a different matter. Perhaps I, too, would strike at the hands that are clinging to the boat, but hardly for the love of life. Rather out of fear, in an attempt to save my own skin. Perhaps it would be a better solution for us all to drown, a final proof of the human species' inability to survive." And that was always very striking to me, because it's not just from him I've seen this reaction. I see this all the time with liberals who consider themselves humanists. When they think humanity does not live up to their expectations, they become very misanthropic and genocidal and wanting to see the human species extinct because a country didn't want to legalize gay marriage or something. I've seen this all the time. And then they project that genocidal tendency onto their political enemies. But I've never met anybody more genocidal than a spiteful liberal humanist.